The sounds of this year's Masters will be echoes.
Definitely more subdued this year with no patrons, but all the players are going to have to figure out a way to find that inspiration nonetheless.
It won't be the same without everybody creating the roars, the nervousness, the jitters.
You know, it certainly won't be the same atmosphere as it is every other year. Still the Masters, you know, they're still giving out a green jacket at the end of it.
We always hear that the Masters is a tradition unlike any other. But right now, in mid-November, with a certain crispness to the autumn air, that line hits pretty different. No, there won't be roaring patrons or blooming azaleas, but the 84th Masters Tournament is teeing off Thursday morning. And today, Scott Van Pelt joins us to provide a personal Masters preview. Unlike any other. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Tuesday, November 10th. This is ESPN Daily. Scott Van Pelt, thank you for joining me on ESPN Daily, man. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure, Pablo.
Scott Van Pelt is the host of the aptly named SportsCenter with Scott Van Pelt and the SV Pod. Scott left for Augusta this morning, but I caught up with him yesterday before his trip. So how good are you at packing? Are you ready for Augusta? What goes into the luggage bag? How many luggages are there?
It's complicated for a regular week because I'm a bit of a clothes, what's the word? Snob? I don't know. I like to dress, you know? It's a visual medium. I like to try. I mean, and I look like a boiled egg, so I like to do what I can to spice things up. Normally, it's however many days we're on, it's a suit for every day, and pocket squares, shirts, ties, options, got to have extra in case somehow we end up sticking around, so it's a heavy bag.
I never considered that you would be a clothes horse. Another term might be a diva, Scott. Are you a fashion diva?
Yeah, I am. I am.
I mean, I'm standing staring at you in my wife's closet. I'm wearing a brown t-shirt, so I am in no position to look down upon anyone.
No one would judge anyone's podcast attire. I mean, if you were nude, it wouldn't trouble me, man. Do whatever you got to do. But I mean, when it comes to being on the air, yeah, absolutely.
Scott, I do think this gives us an opportunity for a segue, though, because the decor, the colors, the aesthetics of Augusta. I mean, that is so essential to the enterprise you're about to embark on when you do head down with your 50 luggages to Georgia. Because usually this thing happens and it's spring, right? Like everyone up north is just getting through winter. We're just surviving, crawling out of our caves. And we see on television the azaleas, the birds chirping. That's the Masters. What's it going to be like when you actually get down there and it's, you know, mid-November?
That's the question I ask myself and don't know the answer to yet. And that's the hardest part to mentally wrap my head around. Because I've been asked quite a bit, are you looking forward to going? Well, of course, the Masters is one of the events that mark the calendar every year. But it's what it represents and it's where it falls in the calendar. This Monday would be the NCAA tournament championship game. And there's typically a big get-together of a bunch of people in the industry down there, a number of players. Our friend Mike Tirico is always there. And typically the night ends late with me, Tirico, a couple of players sitting around BSing about the basketball tournament. Like this week's golf is not even a topic because we got time for that. So, you know, you mark the end of one season, college basketball, on this day of Masters Tournament Week. So just where you are in the mental space is so different. And then getting there, and as you point out, the aesthetic of it is understood. I mean, it's this backdrop of pinks and purples and reds, and the greens are impossibly green, and the colors are just these pastels that make it a vision that you can see all year long when you close your eyes. And it comes out of winter, and now we're getting ready for winter. So I honestly don't know what it will feel like in terms of the lack of those things, but it's my understanding that the golf course looks like the golf course. I mean, they've done nothing to it. It's not like it's looks patchy. Like the one thing about Augusta National, Pablo, is if if they were party hosts, you're not going to get there and they're going to say, ah, man, we don't have any of the vodka or the scotch. We're out. But whatever they need to have to throw their party, they will have.
Yeah, the place that mysteriously is devoid of squirrels is not suddenly going to have a giant rodent problem now that we're doing this.
Damn it, there's 9 possum. There's 9 possum running wild on 2. That just isn't going to happen.
But you mentioned that usually you spend this week talking to players, talking to people around the game. I mean, have you heard anything so far from the actual players? Like Augusta, not just given these circumstances aesthetically being different, but Augusta without patrons, as they're called. What's the dynamic after playing the PGA in August, the US Open in September without fans, to do the Masters without patrons?
It will be significantly different. Doug Ferguson, who does such a great job covering golf on our Masters call, Pablo, asked last week something that I hadn't even thought about, but it was really interesting to ponder. And that's the roars, right? The Augusta roars. Those are well understood. They you know that Tiger's on 13. And you hear a roar. Well, you know it's him, and you can guess. There's a birdie roar. That's like nice applause. There's a roar. Man, he made a 3. He made eagle. Not having that will be not a hindrance, but it's just one less bit of data that you have. Not having people in place, they frame what the shot looks like. Mm. Now, granted, they're hitting to a number, right? If they have 182 yards, they know what club that is. They don't need to see people to know where to aim necessarily, but it's so different from what your visual feedback is. And I mean, I haven't talked to anyone that's played it yet, but I know they've all talked about how it will be so strange to go to certain places where 16, the par 3 16th, which is you're enveloped in people.
Right.
And it'll be no one. I mean, there won't be anyone anywhere, but just the idea of being alone at Augusta, it'll take away from the adrenaline push that they provided unlike any other place. And that's the part that I don't think anyone can know, Pablo, until they're standing there and they're in the midst of it on Sunday.
You mentioned the roar. You mentioned the adrenaline surge from last year when Tiger obviously created a scene that seemed implausible, but also cosmically divine at the same time. Like, of course he was going to do this. Of course this guy in this situation was going to do this. But just take me back to last year. Like, what was it like to witness Tiger do that, given all of the humanity that was coursing around him?
I have been really lucky in my life, Pablo, to have covered that one guy. I was there in 1997 when he changed the sport as a 21-year-old.
There it is, a win for the ages.
I was there when he walked off that 18th green and he hugged his father and he hugged his mother.
There's his mom and dad,
their only child.
At that point, it was a comet streaking across the sky. And everything was about to change. And it did. Well, as we know, what happened in the span of time between his 14th and his 15th, as they say, it's a lot. Okay, now a lot was his own doing. He had issues that lots of people have. He started losing his hair, which lots of people do. He had back issues, which lots of people have. He had a divorce, which lots of people have. And now, as a 40-something with a bald spot and a fused back and a mess that he created, he walks off lifted metaphorically by every voice and patron there.
The return to glory.
They'd have carried him on their shoulders had they been allowed to. And he walks off that green with a roar like I've never heard in my life. And he walks to the same spot and he hugs his son and his daughter. And it's just an impossible closing of a chapter and maybe a book. Maybe that's it for his major championship career. And if it is, the guy that I know wanted more than anything to eclipse Jack, if that's how it ends, that guy would say, I'm good. I'm good. I got to show them what Daddy does. They got to see me be the guy they heard about. And I've seen some pretty cool stuff. I've never in my life seen anything or heard anything like Tiger, Tiger, Tiger when they got done. It was insane. Sports at their best move us. They don't often like that. And I was lucky enough to be there.
You just said a couple of things, Scott, that I want to dive into, because as far as I know, you're the only person who can talk to Tiger on television about said hairline.
About your kids, and I'm smiling looking at the kid on the back of this book with that sensational head of hair. And I've been telling you, bro, for a long time, I am your GPS, and I just want to know when are we going to come home, man? It's time to come home.
No, I've got my helipad up top, and I'm very happy with that.
Okay.
You are able to level with the guy because you have a certain relationship with him built up over the years.
Yeah.
So just for those who are uninitiated into your dynamic, how would you describe your relationship with Tiger Woods?
I've known him a long time, and it's the kind of professional friendship. I always want to frame it that way. You're not supposed to be friendly with people, but I mean, I look at the great Dick Schaap and the kind of relationships that he was able to create with people like an Ali, and having relationships, you know this, having relationships that allow for comfort and trust and to know what things that can be said in confidence, and to know that I can't protect him from himself if the story means it needs to be covered. And for me to understand that because we have a professional friendship, that it doesn't mean he's going to give me what I want every time I want it, because he doesn't owe me that. I met him when he was a freshman, Pablo, at Stanford. That was in 1995.
Yep.
At the NCAA championships in Columbus, Ohio. And I was a young guy at the Golf Channel, and I met at a time where I was younger than anyone else that was necessarily covering him. And I just kept turning up at these significant places where he played well. And following his 97 Masters win, I asked him if he'd sit down with me to talk about it, what he did. And he sat down with me, and I was told that I had 5 minutes, and 45 minutes later, we were still talking, because I had a legal pad of everything that he'd done, and he hadn't yet done it. He hadn't gone through it, and he was ready to do it. So when we started talking that day, it was amazing. He was as good as you'll ever see him in an interview, and it wasn't because I was great. I broke all the – this is very inside the beltway, but I broke all the Sawatsky rules. Okay?
Oh, no open – closed questions, Scott. You asked closed questions.
I asked rambling, nonsensical whatevers, but it didn't make any difference, because Tiger's level of comfort with me was such that he was going to give me great answers even though I asked questions. And so that put me on the map in media, because no one else got that. And, you know, fast forward with the tape, and he does what he does in 2000, and Jimmy Roberts leaves ESPN to go to NBC, and ESPN needs somebody that kind of knows Tiger, and I'm the guy. And so Tiger loves to tell me, you know, he's responsible for my entire professional life, which he is.
I want to get even more invasive, Scott. I want to know what a text message from Tiger is like, just like formatting wise. Is he an emoji guy? Are we talking long sentences? Are we talking detail-oriented punctuation? Like, what does it look like?
Sporadic responses, typically short. You can tell instantly if he's in an expansive mood, because the text exchange with the famous person is always, well, are they bored, or they want to keep going, or is it like, I'm speaking as him now. What's the text I send to Van Pelt to let him know that this is the end of the text chain? I really think you should just be able to write Finn and have that be implicitly understood. But it's sporadic, it's random, and I'm trying to go back to what did we most recently talk about?
Please, let's dive into Scott Van Pelt's cell phone. Let's get completely inappropriately invasive.
No, the last thing we texted about was when they played the U.S. Open at Wingfoot, and I wrote is, how difficult is it? What wins? He wrote it over par for sure. As it turned out, DeChambeau, playing the role of Tiger, was the only person under par. Everybody else was par or worse. So it's typically golf. But then going back through the time, just Father's Day stuff and whatever else. Ah, this is funny. This is something about Augusta. And this is actually, it turned out to be not prophetic. it's going to be bleeping cold in November. Well, it's not. It's going to be like 80. So, I mean, it's just regular talk.
So as for his chances this weekend, you gave a very poetic potential capstone to his run through these majors. But this weekend, what are you actually thinking he's going to produce for you?
Not a whole lot. I mean, the most recent snapshot we got was not particularly good feedback. I mean, I think the field was 77. I think he finished 72nd. He doesn't arrive with any sort of form, as they say in the game. There's too many young people, or younger than Tiger anyway, that are playing too well for me to think he'll just turn up and do it. If he finds himself in the mix, then sure, he can lean on things others cannot. You know, I've done this five times. You have not. If you go back and rewind the tape to last year, I'm convinced that it was the familiarity with the feelings of Sunday at Augusta that helped him win that tournament. Because not just Francesco Molinari, not just Tony Finau, not just Brooks Koepka, they got to the 12th hole and all three of them hit it in the water. Everyone. Mm. Now, is that the nerves? Is that not knowing they can't hit it towards that side of the flag because they'll run out of grass and it'll go in the water? Like, I don't know what it was. I just know that they all did it. They all buckled at that moment, and that conspired to give Tiger the berth that he ran through. But it's putting yourself, as he often says, Pablo, in that position, and I just can't see the path to putting himself in that position as we talk on this Monday.
Up next, Scott, let's talk about the guy who is the talk of the sport right now, Bryson DeChambeau. And I want to get your pick for who's going to put on the green jacket in Butler Cabin on Sunday.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot, taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
The betting favorite among the entire field is Bryson DeChambeau, and he's coming off his first ever major championship win at this year's U.S. Open, and my dad's a huge golfer, golf fan. I am less so, but he just sends me articles about this dude all the time. And the only things I've really processed, admittedly, are that he is super jacked, he drinks like tons of protein shakes, and he crushes the ball. So what do the uninitiated need to know about Bryson DeChambeau heading into the Masters?
That he's this mad scientist golfer. He has put in ridiculous amounts of time and effort into figuring out all the different things that go into the swing equation. Swing speed, ball speed, the rotation on the golf ball, breaks on greens. He's got all these numbers and all this. He's done all this work to figure out the mathematic equation that others don't spend as much time on. And I think there were a lot of people in the sport that kind of rolled their eyes at it. Everybody knows that it's part of it, but just rolled their eyes at like thinking that golf was a math, it's a proof to be solved. Mm. It's not. It's a game to be played. But there's no denying that Bryson has broken some of the codes which have allowed him to do things that others can't. And then he turned into this enormous person who had like 190 mile an hour ball speed off the driver. And it was like, now you're combining that plus the math. And what does it add up to? Well, it adds up to a massive major championship win at Wingfoot. The thing that's interesting about all the math and numbers is that Augusta is a different sort of riddle. And I found this statistic on Twitter, a guy named Justin Ray, who used to be a part of work with us on ESPN. In DeChambeau's last 3 years at Augusta, he's last in total putting, which, as we know, you can hit at 8 miles. That's great. If you three putt a couple times, you know, you leave it the wrong side on these greens, I don't care how far you hit it. I don't care what your math says, because in the end, we still have to add up 18 scores. What do you have? That's something he has to get sorted out. He's the kind of guy that there's some John Daly in there, and that he's going to swing and hit as hard as he can. But I promise you, John never sat down and tried to figure out, like, you know, Pythagorean theorem had anything to do with what my score was going to be.
Yeah, I feel like John Daly in, like, his RV, just visually, is about the opposite from DeChambeau, despite that shared unapologetic streak they have.
As yin to his yang, or as yang to his yin, whichever you want it to be, they are absolutely not the same person.
Another unapologetic personality, though, that I want to get your scouting report on is Jon Rahm, because he is skilled, he is fiery, he has yet to win a major, but he's also only 25. So in terms of what he needs to do to get over the hump and actually win his first one, what's your take on that guy?
Easiest thing in the world to say about him is he just needs to be a little bit less harsh on himself, needs to not self-immolate. When you get pissed off, which you will, you cannot allow that spark to turn into the flame, which turns into, you're gone. You just up he went. And I think that sometimes that becomes a little bit too tidy and convenient. It's not always that. It's hard to win a major, really hard. I keep picking Xander Schauffele to win. And I joke with the folks that ask me, I said, look, at this point, I'm pot committed, because when I don't pick him and he wins, I'm going to be livid that I don't get credit for that. But the point is, I think more than anything, it's about being patient and waiting. We're not good at that in anything in life. And in Rahm's case, I think his fans and he just need to just trust that you get four shots a year at this. And if you're 25, let's just give yourself the next 15 years to get to 40. You can still be competitive at 40, but 15 years, that's 60 majors. You're going to win some in these next 60. So take the long view. Don't stress so much about these next couple of holes, and don't freak out if you're in the mix and you don't knock the door down. Because particularly Pablo at Augusta, I can't tell you how many people we have said, oh, he'll win here. Oh, he's got the game to win here. And then it gets to the end and you say, how the hell did Greg Norman never win Augusta? Mm. How did Tom Weisskopf never win at Augusta? How did David Duval never? How did Ernie Els? How did none of them won? And they were all there with chance after chance. And then you wake up and you don't get to go back because you never won. And so I say it about Dustin Johnson. I say it about Justin Thomas. I say it about Justin Rose. I'll say it about him. I'll say it about Rory.
Rory, I mean, this is his white whale, right? This is his own psychology experiment.
It is, because he will arrive there every single year from now until the end of his career, knowing that when I win this, if I win this, I join the list of those to win the slam. And Tiger was the most recent. I will join them when I win. The same way Jordan Spieth will arrive at the PGA Championship knowing, okay, I've won Augusta, I've won an Open, I've won the U.S. Open, I just need the PGA. But the PGA allows you to go somewhere different every year. You don't walk down the same path with the same sort of mental baggage about that place. And for Rory, same deal. I mean, he's way too good not to win at Augusta. His game's perfect for it. But you can say that about so many people, and he's the only one right now for whom Augusta represents a rare finish line of winning the Grand Slam. And, you know, Rory is such an interesting guy. If you ever have the chance to talk to him, you'd love him, because he's a thinker and he's smart and he reads and he's totally outside the space of golf. Doesn't think about the scorecard as a metaphor for life. It's what his job is. He's good at his job, but he's not going to let it make him who he is as a human. I admire that, but your job is to be the best one of those you can be. And he is, it's maddening to people when he isn't as successful as people think he should be. Like, he ultimately he's the arbiter of that, not you. But I think people look at him and think, God, it feels like there ought to be that gear that it doesn't catch with him. And Augusta's always going to, like the white whale is perfectly said, it's going to be that thing that is, every, and now it's twice in 6 months he gets a crack at it.
So as a gambling enthusiast, observer, aficionado, give me a dark horse. Who have you not mentioned or really dived into deep with me yet that you think can surprise some people?
It wouldn't surprise me in this totally unusual year to see someone that hasn't played it yet put themselves in position. But I just to give you some like name from the back of the pack, I'd just be saying a name to say a name, and I wouldn't believe that they were going to win anyway. Like the idea that you're going to pick somebody that's in the 60s or 70s in the world golf ranking, like they're not going to win. They're just not. There are too many people that are at this crowded top of the pack. They all arrive thinking, yeah, I'm going to do it this time. Koepka hadn't done it yet. He thinks he will. Xander, he thinks he will. Justin Rose, add him to the list. So you think they're going to be like, yeah, shoot. Hey, Matthew Wolf. Hey, cool. It's great to have you here. No, F you. At Augusta more than any other place, when it presents itself, when the moment presents itself, grab hold of it and don't let go because it might never present itself again.
I want to fast forward to Masters Sunday now. And first and most likely last Masters Sunday ever played in November. I think we're all hoping for that, as delightful as the experiment's going to be. Who do you think's going to be wearing this green jacket, man? Who's your pick?
I joked earlier about how I'm picking Xander Schauffele every single week and every single major until he wins. I will say that he was right there last year. He's one of these people that doesn't typically get too high or too low, doesn't shoot 62, but doesn't shoot 75. And I need him to hurry up and win, though. Xander, if you hear this, I need you to win so I'm freed up to pick someone else, because I know you're going to win one of these. And if you do it when I don't pick you, then I'm going to take it very personally. So I'll stick with X. I'm not going to do DMX, X going to give it to you, because I think we were so close.
You were like a second in.
I started to and I stopped.
Oh, Scott.
Hold on. Let me give you some DMX. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, what? Had a very shiny nose. And if you ever saw it, you would even say it glows. Come on. That's one of my favorite things in the whole world. DMX doing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. How did that happen? How did I just do DMX doing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer?
Scott, I had other questions for you, but I no longer want to ask them because I want to save the moment of you doing that and put it into a snow globe and hang it on my fireplace for all time.
It's my gift to you.
Scott Van Pelt, you are an incredible man of leisure and apparently the world, I'm going to go with best, the world's best DMX impersonator. Thank you for joining me on ESPN Daily.
It's always my pleasure, Pablo. Be well.
All right, coming up. The race that's been called the ultimate socially distanced sporting event is underway right now, and it makes the Tour de France look like a ride through the park.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Here's another story I want you to know. At this very moment, 33 human beings are sailing completely alone somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And they've been sailing for 2 days now, ever since leaving the harbor of Le Sable d'Olonne, a coastal town in western France, touching off the 9th edition of the Vendée Globe, otherwise known as the most grueling sailing event ever conceived. The race spans 2 to 4 months and over 24,000 nautical miles, tracing a path that takes these 60-foot sailboats literally around the world and back. ESPN's Bonnie Ford reported on the race and interviewed its participants, so I called her up to have her explain what she calls the ultimate socially distanced event.
All you need to know about the Vendée Globe, Pablo, is that fewer people have completed it than have climbed Everest. And that's an oft-repeated phrase by the skippers. It's a very tough event just to get to the start line. It requires an enormous amount of fundraising, skill, luck, and then getting all the way around is a whole nother endeavor. Unfortunately, they didn't get the big send-off in Les Sables d'Olonne. They didn't allow crowds. There's often, you know, hundreds of thousands of people there. I was there myself 8 years ago. It's one of the most emotional, incredible experiences I've had as a sports writer. I was just a wreck. Not to coin a pun, it was fabulous. And I didn't know it existed, Pablo, until by total chance, 2005, which was the last of Lance Armstrong's tour wins, the tour went through that town. And I stayed there. And I'm hanging out in this restaurant, and there's sailing posters all over the place, and Vendée Globe, Vendée Globe. And I finally, like an idiot, I said to the bartender, like, what is this Vendée Globe thing? And they explained it to me, and that kind of set me on this path.
How would you describe the psychological situation that a sailor in this event finds themselves in?
Let's start with the fact that if you are in this race, you have already spent a good amount of time at sea by yourself. And these folks, men and women, are wired differently. They like the solitude. They like being really jacks of all trades on their boats and having to be navigators and engineers and do PR for themselves and feed themselves and fix problems. I think of them almost as astronauts. They're at the mercy of so many variables, and they're trained to deal with all those variables, but there is always some new situation kind of popping up in their faces, and they have to be extraordinarily adaptable. Right now, they're about to contend with some very nasty weather in the North Atlantic. And of course, the race sets out from the Atlantic coast of France, and they go south, eventually heading for the Cape of Good Hope. And the first couple weeks are sometimes the most perilous for the fleet. High winds, high seas.
Yeah, and the race, to be clear, I mean, what's the range of time spent among the finishers if you actually end up getting to the finish line in this thing?
The record was set 4 years ago in the 2016-17 race, and it's 74 days and change. It's incredibly fast when you think about everything that they're dealing with.
And about how many people tend to finish the race if 33 of them end up starting it?
It can be anywhere from half to two-thirds, depending. There's a lot of new skippers in the race. I would, let's hope for the best, but not everybody's going to finish. That's just a fact.
Yeah, this idea that finishing, surviving this thing is its own sort of victory. I mean, that's an especially resonant sentiment, Bonnie, for everybody, I think, right now. I think of a quote that you have in your piece from a British skipper named Pip Hare. And Pip said, "This sport reflects the times we are in now." What did she mean by that?
Well, I think Pip was referring to the fact that we've all had to be alone and have an aloneness that we hadn't thought about before. Most of us have had to really narrow our worlds in some way in the last 6 or 8 or 9 months. And to be resilient and to problem solve. And that problem solving has often involved technology. And just to be comfortable and know that we can make it through this anxious stretch if we do the right things. This is really an adventure in its purest sense. And I do think there's value in that. And it's also really, really fun to follow, especially now that the skippers have a lot of means at their disposal to communicate with us through video or written blogs or whatever. And you can really get a sense of their personalities through that. I love this event, and it gives me goosebumps just talking about this.
Bonnie Ford, thank you so much for taking me inside the heads and the halls of these incredible people.
Thanks, Pablo. It's a pleasure.
I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.